All right, well, if you guys want to go ahead and find your seats and open your Bibles to Romans chapter 13. I'll give you guys a couple of these. Romans chapter 13 is this where we'll start.
Thank you.
You're welcome, you're welcome. Good morning, good morning, good morning, good morning. Romans. Yes, we'll be in Romans chapter 13. Just to begin with, let's go ahead and read Romans chapter 13, starting in verse 1, which says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. For those who resist will incur judgment." And then we could keep reading, but we'll just stop there because that's enough. But can we all agree that the government has God-given authority? All governing authorities, whether they are good or bad, moral, immoral, Christian, non-Christian, all governing authorities are appointed by God and have authority from God. So as we'll go on later to, as you could read later, they don't bear the sword in vain. They are the servant of God to carry out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. So the government has authority from God. Okay, we would agree there. Now let's go over to Matthew chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16, Matthew 16, 15. Jesus said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for the flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." So by telling Peter you have the keys to the kingdom of heaven, he is indicating, rather, that the church has a certain authority from God. Do you agree? That the church has authority from God. Both of those truths need to be important to us, that the government has authority from God, and therefore we are called to submit to the government. And the church has authority from God, therefore we are called to submit to the church. So here's the big difficult question. Which one has the higher authority? What do you mean? Well, I asked the question to you.
That verse tells it all.
What does that mean? So God has. So you say God has the most authority. I'm still trying to understand what your answer was, Kathy. I heard the verse. Can you explain what you mean by that? Okay, so I can't take that as any sort of answer. I know where you're. I know where I would go with that, but. I don't know where you, but that's not where I want to go, because I don't think that's the relevant point today. But the question that we're trying to answer is, who has the highest authority?
On what authority would we say that God has more authority than Caesar, according to biblical history?
We'll get there. I absolutely agree with D. God has a higher authority. We're going to get there. But because God made the governments. No government gets to tell God what he can and can't do. Right? So this is the big question that is going to shape this season of church history that we're in. Let's pray before we start. Father, please do bless our time as we dive into the depths of church history, that we would understand your word and we would understand too how history shapes the way that we think and understand the world, but also how history at times can go awry and that your people and people who certainly aren't your people will often make a mess of the world that you've made. And so may we rightly see the error, may we rightly humble ourselves and admit that we are not above those errors, but God, learn from the past, and may that shape our present and future. I ask in Jesus' name, amen. So we'll just to bring you up to speed, we've kind of moved through the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th centuries of Christian history. We're in now what we might call the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages between 500 and 1500. And we're just trying to see what's going on in the church. And admittedly, this is a confusing time, not just ecclesiastically, not just with the church, but also politically, as you no longer have the Roman Empire, which seems to rule essentially the known world. You now have a fractured Roman Empire of all these Germanic tribes trying to vie for the power in essentially Europe, as well as people like the Huns coming from the east, and now we'll get in a couple weeks to the role of Islam coming from the Middle East. So I think in 2 weeks we're going to do a whole lesson on Islam and how that has shaped church history. But where we're at today is we're focusing mostly on Europe. And the reason we focus mostly on Europe is because the two major centers of church history, Rome and Constantinople, are both in Europe. And so that's what's going to shape most of church history. It isn't that the gospel had not spread to other parts of the globe at this point, but in terms of what shapes the general tone of church history, that's where we have to focus, is in Europe. So you have in the 8th century, in the 700s, you have all these tribes vying for power and these different groups that are trying to establish their rule. And so we start to see things like modern France, modern Spain, modern Germany, modern Britain starting to establish themselves, not as the nations as we know them today, but as major ruling centers throughout Europe. And a very significant event happens in 1751. In 1751, we are going to meet a French king named Pepin. Okay, now let me just give you a little background why Pepin's going to be significant. Because the French monarchy, their goal is to essentially take over Europe and rule all the landmass and all the people. Well, the problem with that is you have all these barbaric tribes throughout Europe, and they're looking at this saying, how can we possibly rule over all these people with all their different cultures and all their different religions and all their different tribal loyalties? And so the French monarchy's solution is essentially to convert everybody to Christianity, because if you can convert everybody to Christianity and they're already submitted to one authority of the church, then if the government is intertwined with the church, then the government can easily bring all those people under their authority. And so the French monarchy's strategy for taking over Europe, essentially, is to Christianize the tribal people. This should probably not sit well with you, right? That our strategy for world domination is to forcibly make people Christian. As a matter of fact, throughout this season and this kind of time of church history, the late 8th century, early 9th century, and even as we get in a few weeks, we'll talk about the Crusades, some of the philosophy of these political figures was convert or die. So be baptized or you'll die. And so you essentially make people Christian by force. Jesus would say, he who lives by the sword dies by the sword. This is not how we spread the gospel. And yet, because it was politically expedient, it seemed to be the strategy of the French monarchy. So they're going out and they are conquering all these tribes by converting them to Christianity, then submitting them to the supposedly Christian government. This meant then the government started sponsoring missionary efforts. And so the government comes in with their riches and says, hey, we'll send missionaries to all these tribal people. Because just imagine, if you're the French monarchy funding missions to, you know, tribal people in Britain, then that might mean that if they convert to Christianity, they'll also convert to the Roman Empire and the Roman Emperor and become under the authority of the French monarch. So this is what's going on politically. And then in 751, Pepin, who was, you might think of like similar to a prime minister as we might think of it, so that he wasn't a monarch, but he was the guy that was essentially ruling the French Empire, the Frankish Empire. And Pepin, though, wanted to be king. He didn't want to just be the prime minister. And so Pepin overthrew the French monarch. Now, why is that significant? It's significant because Pope Zacharias, the Roman Pope, sanctioned Pepin's overthrow. So he gave the authority and the permission for Pepin to overthrow the French monarchy. So just this is huge because that means that the Pope just appointed a king. And in some effects, the most powerful king in the Roman Empire. So this is a massive shift in church history in 751 because the church authority, ecclesiastical authority, now has intertwined themselves with the political authority. So you see where we're, I don't know if you see where we're going with this, but this is bad news. So Pepin dies, and he passes his kingdom on to his two sons. One of them dies pretty quickly. The other son then is the sole monarch of the French monarchy named Charles the Great, or as we probably mostly know him from church history or from history in general, Charlemagne. So you've probably heard that name, Charlemagne. Charlemagne is Charles the Great. He is the French monarch from 771 to 814. And what's significant about Charlemagne is he steps into the role of Pepin, his father. He rules over the French monarchy, spreading the gospel of the French monarchy to all of these people, now under the authority of the Pope. And so you have to think of, just imagine where he's at. He thinks that he is conquering Europe. The Pope thinks that he is conquering Europe. These two things are likely to not end up agreeing with each other. But Charlemagne isn't just an emperor, he's a great emperor. He turns out to be a brilliant political figure and even spiritual figure in history, such that a lot of his efforts work. He essentially, this is quoting from a church historian, recreated the Western Roman Empire on a Christian basis. So he took what had been a fractured Roman Empire and he started to reunite all of Europe under the French monarchy. And essentially then, but doing it as a Christian state and not just as a political state. So under the authority of the Pope, which meant in the year 800, and this is a very significant year, in the year 800, Pope Leo III, crowned Charlemagne king of the Roman Empire. He made him the emperor of the Romans, and this is what is known as the birth of the Holy Roman Empire. And so if you want to think of maybe the earliest origin of what we now know as the modern Roman Catholic Church, you got to go to Charlemagne. So everything before 800, and I've said, tried to repeat this over, when we say Catholic, we don't always mean Roman Catholic. What we know as the Catholic Church today is not the Catholic Church of most of church history. But in the season of Charlemagne, we really see the dramatic shift to start to form what we now know as the Roman Catholic Church because it's intertwined with the Holy Roman Empire, which meant the Roman Emperor is seen as subject to the Roman Pope because Pope Leo put the crown on Charlemagne's head. So you see, now we have warring authorities. Is Charlemagne king? Or is Pope Leo really the king? Because Leo made Charlemagne king. Charlemagne thinks he's the authority, but Leo thinks he's the authority. And that's probably an overgeneralization, but it captures the tension that's going to arise. Because now you have a king and a pope with differing agendas. And keep in mind, I think as we looked last week, that at this point the Roman Pope is also a political figure because there is no political authority in Rome, in the city. And so throughout Italy, the Roman Pope is starting to become a political authority through land exchanges and through military allies. Of course, Pope Leo and Charlemagne will become great military allies as well. Yeah, Eric.
Would you say that the Middle Ages was kind of the peak of power for the church?
That's an interesting question. The Middle Ages is where the church, and maybe, I don't know if this is where you're getting at, the Middle Ages is where the church rose to its highest political power. So what we see today in the Roman Catholic Church and Pope Francis, he does not have the political clout that Leo would have had, right? So he has more cultural influence than anything. But in terms of political power, the Middle Ages is really where the papacy rises to this sort of massive political might, partly because they're fighting over land and kingdoms. And so if the Lombards are knocking on the door of Rome wanting to sack Rome, well, who's going to come to the rescue? The Pope doesn't have an army, but Charlemagne has an army, right? So the Pope's going to say, hey, send your troops over here. And he has that sort of authority because he appointed Charlemagne as king. Yeah.
My understanding was that in the Middle Ages, the church kind of, in all respects, had more authority than the kings.
Well, and it did. The problem is the kings didn't always like that, right? As a matter of fact, Charlemagne's children did not like that. Charlemagne insisted that his son be crowned by him and not by the Roman Pope, because Charlemagne wanted to be very clear that the Pope didn't have authority over the kingdom. Even though the Pope wanted to be very clear that he did have authority over the kingdom. So if you want, and you want to read some church history through this season, it's rather entertaining, the political maneuvering between the Pope and whoever is considered to be the Roman emperor, essentially, or the emperor of Europe. And then as nations start to fracture and you have Spanish and French and the Britons, like, you're going to start to see them. The question is, does the Pope rule over us, or do we rule over the church? It is really quite a mess. So that scene with Charlemagne probably captures the tension of the church over the next, 200-400 years, from about 800 until really into, as we move closer to the Reformation, where the church loses a lot of its political clout by the time of the Reformation, although certainly still has plenty of that. So that captures the tension, but there's other tension brewing that's going to shape church history, namely what we would call the Great Schism, or the East-West Divide. So remember, Rome being the center of the church in the West, capturing most of Western Europe. In the East, the center of the church is Constantinople, which would have... And then, of course, there were other patriarchs, right, in Jerusalem, in Antioch, in Alexandria. But Constantinople's the center of church life in the East and for the Eastern church. And up to this point, though there were lots of disagreements between Christians in the East and Christians in the West, they would have considered themselves one holy, Catholic, apostolic church, working together even with their little differences. The challenge is the Roman Pope in the West was starting to get really intertwined with the government and starting to take authority that would be questionable whether or not the Pope really had. In the East, that wasn't happening. The bishops and the patriarchs in the East were still working in concert with one another, and generally speaking, and there was no vying for political power. It was very spiritual power very much spiritual influence in the East. And the problem was, and we've seen this before, they were slowly drifting further and further apart. Until a series of political and military and religious controversies, defeats, and betrayals, it's a real messy thing, I probably can't explain it very, very well, led to a massive split in the East and the West Church in the year 1054. And so you have people in Constantinople, let's just think the political authority in Constantinople, facing threats from different tribal people and different other armies. So they call on Rome to help, and Rome comes and helps. That is, until certain people die, and then Rome pulls back and says, because Rome wanted the people, the Christians in the East, to submit themselves to Rome, which they would have considered to be the highest authority now, and the Christians in the East said no, and then they said, hey, we're going to pull out our military might then, and we're going to excommunicate you. And the church in the East, and I think I'm trying to remember the guys' names, there were two historical figures that were really hard-headed, and they were the ones negotiating this whole political mess and spiritual mess. They were really hard-headed, and they essentially came to each other and said, we're excommunicating everybody in the Western church. That's what the Eastern people said. And the Western people said, we're excommunicating everybody in the Eastern church. And so in 1054, we have the Great Schism, the Great Divide. To whereas now, after 1054, there is no longer, the East and the West would consider themselves the one true church and the other to be heretics and in error. So you have the Western Catholic Church that's centered on Rome and the papacy, what we would now call the Roman Catholic Church. And then you have in the East what we would call the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is going to be centered in Constantinople primarily, although Jerusalem and Antioch and Alexandria will still have some influence. These are the patriarchs throughout what we call the Byzantine Empire, although in Constantinople and in the East, they would have considered themselves to be the Roman Empire until they're overthrown later by the Ottomans. We'll get to that in a future lesson. So that's a lot of history. I don't know how much you guys remember from world history when you were in school, but it's a massive, just a mess of vying for political power. Let's talk about the positives. I've broken these up right into our kind of common headings. The consistent confession. For all the bad that Charlemagne brought into the kingdom, he did bring great religious reforms. And most of these took place through kind of his spiritual advisor and the guy that he appointed that had the most influence, a guy named Alcuin. I'm probably saying that wrong, but Alcuin, who of York. And he's the schoolmaster of the Frankish Empire. And what Alcuin does is he establishes Latin as the language of the educated class. So this is not going to be just established. This is throughout the whole Western Roman Empire, the whole Roman Catholic Church, we might think, but the whole West is now going to be using Latin as the language of the educated class. And this will be significant as history plays out and the Roman Church starts to set up centers of education because everybody's then educated in Latin and writes in Latin. And if you can read Latin, you can be educated. If you can't read Latin, you can't be educated. Well, that's tied right in with the fact that Alcuin would then establish the Latin Vulgate, which we talked about a few weeks ago from Jerome, as the official Bible, which was written in Latin. That's the Bible now for the empire. He updates it and edits it, and then they mass produce as much as they can. This is before printing press, the Bible in Latin. Now, if you know a little bit about the Reformation and where church history is going, this seems great, right? Now we have a standardized language, a standardized Bible, and everybody can be brought under that, which is really helpful in some ways. The problem is only the educated class can read Latin. Everybody else speaks tribal languages, common languages that we may, even as they develop into what we know today. Well, if you can't read Latin, you can't read the Bible. And down the road, a number of centuries, the Roman Catholic Church is going to say the only Bible that you can read is in Latin. You know, they're going to make it illegal to translate the Bible into other languages, which will play into the whole story of the Reformation. And so you have, in a positive sense, a very crisp, clean translation of the Bible distributed to the people. In a very negative sense, that's actually going to exclude people in the long haul. But it is somewhat of a consistent confession within the church because it does provide some stability. Thankfully, people that could read Latin then could read the Bible and translate it into other languages. That's all in the West. In the East, the common language was Greek, and so they would have used Greek copies of the scripture. Alcuin also established libraries. And what he did with these libraries is he would then translate ancient literature and ancient theology into Latin, and these libraries would be useful then for the educated class. And so we don't just have the establishment of Latin as a common language, but now libraries filled with books translated into Latin. Supposedly, a lot of the ancient pieces of literature that we would look to, whether that's reading Plato or Aristotle or even Augustine, we're looking back to copies that Alcuin was responsible for preserving and putting into the ecclesiastical, the church libraries. And so Charlemagne, and this is all under the authority of Charlemagne. Charlemagne saying, go and do this, and this will be good for the kingdom. And so this is really a positive shift in some ways because it does give us a lot of good information and it brings some stability to the church. The negative side of it will play out as eventually the Roman church doesn't see Latin as just convenient. They see it as mandatory. And that will exclude the common people, which is what the Reformation tried to then recover. So there's some consistency. The big problem, of course, during this time is who is the supreme authority. And this is what Eric alluded to, right? That you have political power fighting against church power. And the big question is, who's the supreme authority? Is it the government or is it the church? Who gets to decide who is king and which nation should be conquered and on and on and on we could go? Who even eventually gets to decide who gets to appoint bishops, which will be a major problem down the centuries that the king, say the French king, decides he should appoint the French bishops, and the Pope will say, no, I get to appoint the French bishops, and then they'll fight and squabble. And here's a great quote to kind of maybe capture this issue. So long as the church and state were united and seen as two aspects of a single Christian society, the possibility of religious and political conflict between the Pope and the Emperor were all too real. And that's how they saw themselves. We're supposed to be working together to overrule God's world, the government and the church. And as long as they saw themselves as two parts of a singular whole, there was going to be conflict and problem. This is probably some of the greatest fruit of the Reformation is, in a sense, what we now would call the modern separation of church and state. These are not intertwined authorities, they're distinct authorities. And so, yeah, Dale, were you going to say something? Did I see your hand?
Mm-hmm. What they would do wasn't very godly, as I read.
Yeah.
It was dreadful, the kinds of punishments that they would give people for even the slightest change from their philosophy, you know, how it was dictated to them. That's what I found quite difficult as I studied.
Yeah, one of the darkest parts of church history is that, at least from our perspective looking back, is that if the church and the state are intertwined as equal authority, then and if heresy is offense against God, then that means the government has the right to put heretics to death. And that is practiced frequently through church history. The real trouble with that is oftentimes determining what heresy is.
But the church dictated.
Yes. Yeah, to some degree. And I mean, that they're, depending on how much the king is willing to submit to the Pope, the Pope can say, hey, that person's a heretic, they should be put to death. The king can choose to do that or not. And certainly some of them did. And I think that that's really confusing for us because we don't really have a category in 21st century America for putting a heretic to death. But the Bible does. I mean, it's what we see all throughout the Old Testament. You disobey God, you abandon God, you get stoned to death, you get put to death for it. And so we might look back and say, man, that the church was totally out of line for putting heretics to death. Well, we can make an argument that they were. Sometimes, usually they were. But they would be making a biblical argument. This is what happens in the Bible.
That's true. In the Old Testament, right? You will kill every last one of them.
Yeah. And they would be purging then falsehood from the earth, and the way that you purge from the earth is by burning and by drowning. And so this is what the church would have done, not just in the Middle Ages, but on even through the Reformation.
And it's still happening today, not in this country, but in other parts of the world.
Well, and we could look at something like Islam that still has that policy. Like blasphemy is punishable by death. And though we certainly would disagree with Islam's definition of blasphemy, they would be trying to argue that that's an appropriate punishment for somebody who blasphemes God. And so it does bring a bit of tension because church history is far more violent than 21st century Christianity in America. But we're also a very isolated group in America. The people around the world understand the violence that comes with Christianity. A lot of our brothers and sisters facing persecution. What we would probably then argue is wrong and reckless would be the government sanctioning of the church killing people for the sake of spreading the gospel. That gets the we'll talk about the Crusades in a couple weeks, and even with what we find with Charlemagne, kind of the convert or die mentality of the tribes is not biblical at all. And really, this period of church history is really bloody, even becoming to the point where you have Eastern Christians fighting Western Christians to the death. It's just a mess. And I would argue that the reason is the question that I asked at the beginning of this lesson. Who has the highest authority? Is it government or is it the church? And it's a great question, but it's a trick question. Because it isn't the government as an institution that has the highest authority, and it isn't the church as an institution that has the highest authority. It's God that has the highest authority. And this is going to be the real fruit of the, and it's bad fruit, of the medieval times, the Middle Ages, is that you have two vying authorities that are actually neglecting the supreme authority of God. The church is, and this is going to be the argument of the Reformation, the church is created by the word. Right? The Bible, the gospel, is what creates the people of God, and therefore all people of God are subject to God and to his word as our supreme authority. The Roman Catholic Church is going to argue that no, the church is the supreme authority over the people of God because the church created the word. And we'll get to that whole mess when we get to the Reformation. But that's the issue, is what's the highest authority? And if we say, well, the government has the highest authority from God, then that means that the government gets to dictate what the church has to do. If the church says, no, we have the highest authority from God, then that means that we dictate what the government gets to do. The reality that seems to be abandoned is that the word has authority over both the government and the church, and there's distinction, right? The church, the government does not bear the sword in vain, right? They can punish what is evil. That is a God-given authority. The church is given a different sort of authority, the keys to the kingdom of heaven, not the keys to the prison cells, right? But the keys to the kingdom of heaven, to be able to declare the truth of God and to declare what is right and what is wrong amongst the people of God. So we both have our authorities rooted in the word, but what seems to be missed in the Middle Ages is that the word has the highest authority, that God has the highest authority. Rather, you have two lesser authorities vying for supreme authority. And that's what I think creates the problem with that'll lead to the Reformation. Yeah, Kathy.
Okay. There's a gentleman who is a pastor. His father was formerly a pastor. When he was pulled over for speeding, he told the police officer, "Do you know who my father is?" I quit reading his books at Barnes and Noble because he did not take responsibility for his earthly responsibility to the government for pulling him over and obeying the laws of the land. They take pictures of people who are speeding now. And
sure. Sure, and as Christians, we are submitted to the government authorities, right? But if the government tells me that it's illegal to gather and worship Jesus, I am free to rebel against the governing authority. That is not their, that's not the authority they've been given. They've been given the authority to punish wrongdoing, not the authority to tell us who can and cannot worship Jesus, and when we can and cannot worship Jesus. So where the government has been given authority, it's different than the church. To the same degree, like, I do not have the authority to issue the death penalty to somebody. As a pastor in the local, I have authority as a pastor in a local church. Some authority that the Bible will say which Christians are to be submitted to. But that does not give me the right to execute the death penalty on anybody. It does give me the right to say that's sin and you need to repent. It does give me the right to say this is what God has said and we need to obey it. But that authority is very distinct. Right, and it's authority that's submitted to its own realms. And this is the problem with the Middle Ages. And what Eric was getting at is the political influence of the church and the government start to get so blurred that it's as if they forgot God was in charge.
The Holy Wars.
We'll get to the Holy Wars and the Crusades. Yeah, and we'll... What's that? Even today, yeah, and we'll get to the nature of the Crusades, because the nature of the Crusades is essentially sending government military troops that weren't even necessarily Christian to go and convert the Muslims and recapture Jerusalem, which convert really just meant kill. And so that we can look at that and go, that is so ugly, it's so wrong on so many fronts, and I would ask the question, why? And I think the reason why is that that along the lines, both the church and the government abandoned God as their supreme authority, right? And that's really going to be the issue. It starts to become man as supreme authority. So that is what causes the greatest confusion during the Middle Ages, and eventually will come to fruition with the Protestant Reformation. Now, it's going to be very expedient for the Protestant reformers that the government, that the church has a certain degree of political clout, because people like Martin Luther are able to live and write and preach under the protection of a German king, essentially. Not a king, but like a, I don't remember what he was, a duke or something. You know, they have a zillion categories. But he's able to function because though the Roman emperor wants him dead, his local monarch says, no, I'm going to give him safety, right? And so that political power of the government actually plays really well for the reformers. And at the same time, the grandchildren of the Reformation find that to be very difficult, which is where, because when church and state are intertwined, you quickly have a recipe for disaster, which is where people like the Free Church comes from, saying that the government should have no authority over the exercise of worship in the church. And then along with many of our other modern Protestant denominations like Baptists and whatnot come out of that same idea of separation, we might say, of church and state. And even American democracy, right, which comes out of, is very similar in how we would see that. So that's the major conflict. Another major conflict that comes up during this time is the center of worship. So we would all agree, I hope, that the worship of Jesus should be the supreme pursuit of the church, right? We're here to worship Christ. How that happens takes a dramatic shift during the time of the Middle Ages, particularly during the time of Charlemagne. For most all of church history, the Lord's Supper, or maybe we would call back then, they would maybe call the Eucharist or communion, whatever word you want to use for it, was the high point of Christian worship. This is why, even to this day, we do the Lord's Supper last in our services. It's because it is intended to be the high point of Christian worship, that we are leading up to the remembrance of the thing that we are most celebrating, right? The death and resurrection of Jesus. So throughout all of church history, that's been the case. And so you would, oftentimes worship would climax in the taking of the Lord's Supper for all the people. Now, without giving you a whole history of what had happened, during the time of Charlemagne, a major shift happened in how the Eucharist was practiced. No longer was the everyday average Christian allowed or permitted to take the Lord's Supper every week in the West. In the East, they still did. In the West, rather, instead, the weekly worship culminated on the priest taking the Lord's Supper with the people watching. Okay, now why is that such a significant shift? It's a significant shift because it starts to create a divide between clergy, and we might use the word laity. It creates a massive divide that you kind of have these super Christians that are progressing and as priests that get to experience worship, but the everyday Christian cannot. The average Christian was only permitted to take the Lord's Supper on Christmas, on Easter, and on Pentecost, and then over time, usually just on Easter, and then over time, usually never in their life were they permitted to take the Lord's Supper. So you see a shift not in what we do in worship, but who gets to participate in worship, which totally perverts the nature of the gospel, right? We take the Lord's Supper not to remember that Jesus built just a church. We take the Lord's Supper to remember that Jesus built a church, but we take the Lord's Supper to remember that we are all part of that church. We're all members of the body of Christ. And so 1 Corinthians is going to point us that we are unified by the bread that we eat and the cup that we drink. And what happened in this shift of worship is it started to elevate the clergy to the only ones who took the bread and the cup, leaving the laity behind. And this plays right into all these other issues we've talked about like the Latin Bible that was for the educated classes when the common classes didn't speak Latin, couldn't read Latin. And so we see in this time of the period of Charlemagne and from then on a divide, not just East and West Church, not just church and state, but between the everyday average Christian and the clergy. And you start to create classes of Christianity, which again become a massive problem. I'll give you two more points, and I have a couple. We can take time for a couple more questions. In terms of the authority that comes from God, I think we've already addressed this, is what role does God play in all these things? With the church and the state vying for power, it's almost as if God gets forgotten when he is the supreme authority. But even through all the mess of the Middle Ages, we can say that God was still faithful in preserving his church. For all the bad that the Latin Vulgate may have caused among the common people, it still was preserved by powerful people that could reproduce it in mass so that when the scriptures are recovered for the common people, they have Bibles in their hands that they can use to translate. Even the building of just the infrastructure of the church during the Middle Ages provides a platform for for Christianity to survive. As Charlemagne, yes, spreads the, you know, French monarchy's gospel by convert or die,
The gospel is still going forth and people still are converted. And so through all the ugliness of man, God is still faithful to preserve his truth. He's faithful to preserve the gospel and to spread it through the world. Yeah, Eric. Yeah, I mean, some of that history is a bit debated about how, yeah, like you said, it's a little unclear. Certainly, and we can even go back, I think this goes back even to Constantine, of taking, as they're trying to contextualize the gospel to the people that they're reaching, and starting to shift some of their holidays to line up with Christian celebrations. So certainly, the major holidays, Christmas and Easter, find their a lot of their common practices because they were imposed on a calendar that was already being used by the people. And so, you know, we all would, you can just do a little bit of simple, just work with a calendar and realize Jesus wasn't born in December, right? But, so why do we celebrate Christmas in December? Well, it was because because the church was celebrating Christmas. And the question was, when do we appropriately celebrate the birth of Christ? And it had to do very much with intertwining with festivals that celebrated, you know, the time of darkness before the light would dawn. And so that's probably way over generalization. But yeah, there is the origins of Christmas and Easter as we know them have a lot of pagan influence. A lot of pagan influence. On the flip side of that, we can't ever forget that Christians have seen it expedient from before that time and from that time to celebrate the birth of Christ and the resurrection of Christ. And so taking cultural traditions and leveraging them for use in the church is, yes, at times dangerous, and we should avoid it, and at other times it seems to be somewhat permissible in the scriptures. I would use the example of head coverings in 1 Corinthians 11. That wasn't that the church said women should cover their heads as a symbol of authority, but that it was cultural that women covered their heads for a symbol of authority. And Paul saw that as expedient for the Corinthian church to communicate that same authority because it was already a cultural practice. So maybe there's some room in there. But yeah, a lot of the origins of some of the ways in which we celebrate Christmas and Easter have a lot of pagan origins that have then been leveraged by the church. For better or for worse. Yeah, Cheryl.
I wonder what Bible the Eastern Orthodox Church
used. That's a great question. They primarily would have used Greek translations of the Bible. You know, I'm not 100% sure if there's one kind of standard Greek text that they use throughout Eastern Orthodoxy, but that's a good question. There's none that rings a bell off the top of my head. But Greek would have been the language that they used. And so they would have certainly have distributed the Septuagint, that Greek translation of the Old Testament. And then a Greek editions of the New Testament, which would having been written in Greek, wouldn't necessarily require the same sort of translation production that a Latin version of the Bible did, because that would require translation. Remember, Jerome was kind of one of the first to translate the New Testament from Hebrew, or the Old Testament from Hebrew into Latin. So I don't know of a standardized version among Eastern Orthodoxy, but there could be one. That's a good question. The Septuagint, probably of the Old Testament, would have probably been their primary use. Yeah. One of these days I'll do a Sunday school series on where we got our Bible, and I'll probably be able to answer that more thoroughly. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Very simplistic deal. The other one was the Latin. It reminded me of the Tower of Babel. Let's confuse them with putting out all these different languages. Catholic Church did the same. Let's do this Latin thing in a time when education was so rare and learning was so rare, and they have something, anything on a printed
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Huh. Yeah, no, there really isn't. That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that Tower of Babel issue. But yeah, the kind of the one world languages becomes an issue within the church. And especially as we're trying to reach people with the gospel that don't speak Latin or Greek in the case of the Eastern Church, which both of those play out more in church history.